rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Japal Harris, Judge Werke, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Japal Harris presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Japal Harris. In a moment, we are going to begin calling cases. Before we do call the cases, just a couple of reminders. The podium has a button on the left side that you can adjust the podium up or down, so please do so at your comfort. Each side will have 15 minutes with the appellant having a five-minute rebuttal. With that, Madam, Mr. Clerk, if you want to call the first case.
First case, 824-0106, Lee Michael Schurer, appellant, versus Douglas Shrewsbury as Special Administrator for the State of Anne Milland, respondent.
And counsel, you can proceed when you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Matt Barber, along with my colleague, Courtney Lawrence, here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Scheuer. As the court's aware, we've got two issues, both involving pre-verdict interest, and they're both reviewed de novo. The first issue is an order of operations issue. It's what happens first. Is pre-verdict interest attached to the amount the jury awarded first, or are collateral sources taken away first and then pre-verdict interest added back into it?
I'm not interrupting your argument, but could you speak a little louder? We have this background noise, which is, I think, air conditioning, but it's, yeah, thanks.
Thanks for letting me know, Your Honor. Is this better?
Yes, better.
Okay. Thank you. So starting with the order of operations issue, it should be pre-verdict interest that attaches first, and that's because pre-verdict interest is an element of compensatory damages. It's part of the injury that the jury awards compensation for based on the defendant, in this case, liability. It's different than conventional interest. Conventional interest solely exists to compensate for the loss of use of money over time. And the case that supports that is the Minnesota Supreme Court's case in Lionheart versus State. In addition, this is supported by both the pre-verdict interest statute and the collateral source statute. Under the pre-verdict interest statute, it provides that interest shall accrue on the pecuniary damages. Under the offer-counteroffer provision, which we have, there's still pre-verdict interest that exists, and the offer is what's operative under the offer-counteroffer provision there. Under the collateral source statute, it doesn't mention pre-verdict interest at all, and the pre-verdict interest statute is in derogation of the common law. It's construed strictly and narrowly. It only applies as expressly written, and it doesn't provide for interest at all. In subdivision 2, it explains under the circumstances that it applies, and it applies to damages that have been awarded up through the time of the verdict, and pre-verdict interest is certainly one of those elements of damages. I can move on to the second issue, when does interest accrue under our circumstances, unless the court has any questions.
Well, let me ask you this question. You're arguing that 549.09 is not ambiguous and that we should apply the plain language. Is there reason to have a precedential opinion on these points to clarify this for practitioners?
I think it would be helpful because the pre-verdict interest issue is kind of, it hasn't really been decided yet. We don't have the order of operations being expressly stated in a decision from an appellate court in Minnesota. So I think that would be helpful, even though subdivision 1B is it's unambiguous, it's clear. But then the interaction between that statute and the collateral source statute, because there's no express guidance, it would be helpful to have a precedential decision from this court explaining how the order of operations goes.
So what would you see as a syllabus point for the order of operation or the roadmap for practicing attorneys?
So I think the syllabus point would be something like pre-verdict interest is an element of compensatory damages. As an element of compensatory damages, it attaches to the verdict before collateral sources are reduced. Something, two sentences like that.
But so let's go down that path for a second. You have the pre-verdict interest that attaches before collateral sources are reduced. If then you go and take the offset of the collateral sources, why wouldn't the interest on that collateral source also be deducted? Because we're talking about the medical bills, right? And so if you add the interest on top of the medical bills, then you go to the offset, and that's all money that you're not entitled to with the offset of the medical bills, so the interest would go with it.
So under Lionheart, pre-verdict interest is different than conventional interest. It's different than loss of money over time. And by applying the collateral source statute before pre-judgment interest, then there wouldn't be that double payment or payment on interest that would be coming out of the award, essentially. We're taking it out consistent with the plain language of the pre-verdict interest statute and the collateral source statute and Lionheart, because the collateral source statute doesn't exist to take away full compensation. It's there to prevent double recoveries. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in Lionheart tells us that pre-verdict interest is an element of compensatory damages. So by applying this consistent with the Jewett case, which says you take out the collateral sources before pre-judgment interest attaches, we're preventing that double payment of the payment, which is what the collateral source governs, and the interest on it, because there wouldn't be pre-judgment interest on that amount.
Well, you certainly agree that Lionheart doesn't say anything or mention anything about whether interest attaches to the verdict or to the judgment. I mean, unless you have some other clarity in reading Lionheart, would you agree with that?
I want to make sure I understand the court's question.
You're saying Lionheart is applicable?
I am. I'm saying...
Respondent is saying, no, it's not applicable, and is taking the position that it doesn't specifically direct whether, in fact, interest attaches to the verdict or to the judgment.
Oh, okay. I mean, Hogginson is also instructive on that from the Court of Appeals in 2014. Hogginson relies on Lionheart and says that pre-verdict interest attaches to the verdict. It's part of the statute. The statute calls it pre-verdict interest because it's an award on the pecuniary damages up through the time of the verdict. So Lionheart might not say it as expressly that way, but it is interest on the verdict, on those pecuniary damages up to the time of the verdict. So it is pre-verdict interest attaching to the verdict. And I believe it says that, yeah, pre-verdict interest attaches to the verdict an additional compensatory sum. So it does say it that clearly, Your Honor. It says it at page 865 of the opinion.
I'm still hung up on the point that when you take the offset, because you're not entitled to recovery of those medical bills, and so then why would you be entitled to interest on money that you're not entitled to in the first place?
By applying it before prejudgment interest, we're still satisfying that part of the collateral source statute, and we're still giving effect to Lionheart, saying that pre-verdict interest is a different type of interest. It's actually not interest at all. It's an element of compensatory damages. So we are limiting interest on those damages that would be covered by collateral sources by having the collateral source statute apply before the prejudgment interest attaches, and by taking out that payment. So we're still following cases like Brewster. We're not getting a payment for a collateral source that was paid by an insurance company, and we're not getting prejudgment interest on it, which is the conventional type of interest. So we're satisfying those concerns by having the collateral source statute apply before prejudgment interest happens, but it shouldn't apply before pre-verdict interest attaches, because they're different kinds of, they're different elements. One is essentially a remedy, something that attaches as an add-on. The other is an element of damages. It's part of the tort case, or part of the elements of the tort, in this case, damages.
But so in Brewster, it talks about a portion of the medical bills that he never paid, never will have to pay, is something that's not recoverable. And so if you have these medical bills that you never paid, never will have to pay, why do you get interest on that?
Because the Minnesota Supreme Court says pre-verdict interest attaches to the amount awarded by the jury, that additional compensatory sum to more fully compensate the plaintiff. And the collateral source statute doesn't apply to prevent a full recovery. It applies to prevent a double recovery. That's like cases what Doe and Imlay say. In addition, the collateral source statute only addresses payments. It doesn't address interest at all. And again, it's construed strictly, applies only to the extent it says expressly. That's Getz versus Peace. Getz versus Peace also says that exceptions to the collateral source statute are construed broadly. So we could rely on that guidance from the Minnesota Supreme Court as well to say that allowing pre-verdict interest to attach first is consistent with everything I've said so far. It's also consistent with Getz versus Peace's interpretation of the collateral source statute. I can move on to the when does the interest begin issue, if the court has any other, unless the court has any other questions on this first issue. All right, so the second issue is when does pre-verdict interest begin to run when we've got an offer? And here, subdivision 1B is clear that when you have an offer, what matters is the offer, and is the offer closer to the amount awarded by the jury? And if it is, then you're allowed pre-verdict interest from the date of the notice of claim through the time of the verdict.
No question, I was just waving my hand.
Gotcha, thank you, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer any questions the court has on that point, but I think our arguments in our brief very thoroughly cover that. All right.
Well, let me bring up then, I asked you before about the plain language of the statute. Wouldn't that also apply here as far as the two-year time period? The statute seems to be pretty straightforward.
I agree with that, Your Honor. But the district courts have gone different ways on it, and we pointed that out in our brief. So I think having a decision that's precedential from an appellate court in the state of Minnesota would clarify that for the district courts that says when you're within the offer, counteroffer provision, the two-year commencement requirement does not apply. I'm happy to answer any of the court's questions. Otherwise, we'd ask that the court reverse on both issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the respondent, Douglas Shrewsbury, as special administrator for the estate of Ann Maland. The trial court correctly calculated pre-judgment and pre-verdict interest in this case. First, it was right to conclude that appellant is not entitled to interest on amounts that represent collateral sources for which he cannot recover. 549.09 allows interest on the judgment or award. Those are the words used by the statute to calculate the principal on which interest is calculated. Judgment plainly cannot include collateral sources because the collateral source statute directs that those amounts be reduced from the verdict before judgment is entered. And in context, it's clear that verdict and award are different. Those terms are both used in 549.09. And they mean different things. And it's meaningful that when the legislator talks about the principle on which interest is calculated, it only uses judgment or award, not verdict. And then if there was any doubt about the plain language of the statute, this is one of the rare cases where the legislative history is extremely clear that award means an arbitration award, not the verdict. And so, if you look at the plain language of 549.09, it allows interest on the judgment or award, not on the verdict, as appellant has argued. Now, appellant tries to get around that by repeatedly referring to case law that describes pre-verdict interest as compensatory. And it is compensatory in a sense, but it compensates for the loss of use of money, for the time value of money. And when we're talking about amounts that the plaintiff is not entitled to recover at all because they're collateral sources, there is no loss in the time value of money. And so there's nothing for the pre-verdict interest to compensate for in those circumstances.
And that's the piece that I find to be your strongest argument and the appellant's weakest argument, because I don't see how you get interest on money you're not entitled to. The piece that I find for weak for your argument is that the statute's very clear that there's five things that are excluded, and collateral source medical bills is not one of them. And so it seems like there could be a gap in the statute of how maybe it should work, but the legislature hasn't done that. So how do we deal with the express language of the statute that does not exclude this?
Well, if you look at those five things that are listed, all of those five things are things that would ordinarily be included in the judgment. And collateral sources are never included in the judgment because they're taken out before the judgment is entered. And so that's how I think you can distinguish. There was no need for the legislator to explicitly say there's no pre-verdict interest on collateral sources, because of course there isn't, because they're not in the judgment. Whereas those other items that were listed are different. They're in the judgment, and so you have to expressly say there's no pre-verdict interest. That's how I would respond to that argument.
But it does talk about the pre-verdict in this statute at the end, except as otherwise provided, pre-verdict, pre-award interest shall not be awarded on the following. And so it is pre-verdict, not necessarily pre-judgment. And then there's these five things here. So, I mean, in the express language of the statute, seems to me that that's against your argument.
No, but then under subdivision C, or 1C, where it talks about the principle on which it's calculated is the judgment or award. And so all of these things where it says except as otherwise provided by contract or law, pre-verdict, pre-award, or pre-report interest shall not be awarded on the following, those are all items that, if not for that sentence, would be in the judgment or award. And so that's why the statute needs to exclude them. But collateral sources are never in the judgment or award, so there's no need to include them. It's also not relevant that pre-verdict interest is not explicitly listed in the collateral source statute, because the question is not whether pre-verdict interest is a collateral source, it's whether the appellant or the plaintiff is allowed pre-verdict interest on what are undisputably collateral sources. So that also does not help plaintiff's argument. Again, the Linehart case, it says pre-verdict interest is an element of damages awarded to provide full compensation by converting time of demand damages into time of verdict damages. And again, that conversion of the time value, it doesn't make any sense when you're not entitled to the money to begin with. So for all of those reasons, the court was correct to set off collateral sources before calculating pre-verdict interest. In addition, the court was also correct to conclude that pre-verdict interest cannot begin to run at the time of the notice of claim in this case, because the action was not commenced within 2 years of the notice of claim. 549.09 says very clearly the action must be commenced within 2 years of a written notice of claim for interest to begin to accrue from the time of the notice of claim. Nothing that follows that changes that clear requirement. There's nothing that says that no longer applies as you continue to read down the paragraph. And there's no need for the legislator to repeat itself one or two sentences later when it's already made that clear statement. Appellant has relied on the phrase except as provided herein, but that appears before the requirement that it be commenced within 2 years. So the requirement that it be commenced within 2 years is the exception to the general rule that it would apply from the notice of claim or commencement of the action, whichever occurs first. It's not saying that there are further exceptions that somehow negate the requirement that it be commenced within 2 years. And to the extent there's any unclarity in the law, the purpose of the statute clearly supports this interpretation. It's supposed to incentivize people to commence their actions in a timely manner, and an appellant's interpretation would do the opposite. It would encourage people to serve a notice of claim and then wait for 6 years to sort of run up interest, and that can't be what the legislator intended by this.
Do you agree that the practicing bar would benefit from a precedential opinion, or do you think that the legislation, the provisions we're talking about, are clear and there is no further need for guidance, case by case versus a roadmap?
I do think the statutes are clear, but I mean, I would acknowledge that there's no existing appellate case law on this issue, so I think it could go either way. And unless the court has other questions.
I'd like to ask the same question I asked to the appellant. So why if you follow the sort of maze of the puzzle of the statute here, and you go through and you say, okay, add the interest in under 548.251, you add the interest in, and then you go to 548.251, and you remove all the collateral sources, which would include the interest on the collateral source, you'd end up in about the same place you are now. Is that a fair reading of how this works? Or is that when you do the collateral source, is that separate? Do you not include the interest when you're taking out the collateral sources?
I think you should take out the collateral source first and then calculate the interest rather than taking out, if I understand you correct, taking out the, like applying the interest and then taking it out when you take out the collateral sources. Is that, if I'm following
basically,
correctly?
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I think that the statute is better read to say, take the collateral sources out and then calculate interest. But I guess I haven't run the math to determine if there's much of a difference between those two.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We just ask that the court affirm in all respects.
Thank you.
I'll start with the plan language of 549. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Poehler has held that it's unambiguous and it provides for pre-verdict interest on all pecuniary damages except for the five items that are listed at the bottom of subdivision 1B. We don't fall under any of those five subdivisions, so pre-verdict interest does attach here under the plan language of the statute and Poehler. To the concern about interest on damages that were covered by collateral sources, appellant would not be getting conventional interest on those collateral source payments because prejudgment interest is that type of conventional interest, and the collateral sources would come out before prejudgment interest attaches to it. So that application should assuage those concerns. With respect to the offer or counteroffer provision. It's an if-then conditional statement type of statute, and it lists its conditions. It lists what's required, and if those are all met, then it's clear that it says interest shall be awarded as follows, and what matters is the offer being closer to the amount awarded, and if that happens, then interest is allowed from the date of the notice of claim. Under 548.251 subdivision 2, and its definitions of what collateral sources are. Collateral sources are payments. They're not interest. It's not listed at all. And again, this statute is construed narrowly because it's in derogation of the common law. Unless the court has any questions, I'm happy to sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This matter has been submitted. The court will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both.